Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1188, I will have four segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide and catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip. During the second segment, I will talk about the latest International Court of Justice ruling that says Israel must allow aid into Gaza. I will share with you that ICJ ruling. During the third segment, we will listen to an opinion by Soumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, on the Palestinian hostages apartheid Israel released recently from captivity. During the fourth segment, we will listen to Avi Schleim, Jewish history professor and one of the world's leading Middle East historians. I will air the speech he delivered on Zionist settler colonialism at the Gaza Tribunal final session. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 748 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Since the ceasefire came into effect on October 10th, Israel has continued to violate the basic terms of the agreement, including killing and injuring Palestinians while maintaining restrictions on food and humanitarian aid entering Gaza. On Friday, October 17th, at least 11 people from the same family were killed in an Israeli attack on a car in Al Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. Journalist Saeed Hezbollah filmed relatives mourning over the bodies of their loved ones at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City. Of the 11 people killed, 7 were children between 5 and 13 years old. Hezbollah said that Israel bombed the vehicle as they were checking on their destroyed home. Quote, they had hoped the war was over, that they could return to live upon the rubble of their house, but the occupation's artillery ended their lives the moment they arrived, he stated on social media. Gaza's civil defense stated that rescue workers recovered the bodies of 9 of the victims, but the bodies of 2 children were not recoverable as they were torn apart due to the intensity of the bombardment and the difficult field and environmental conditions in the area. On Sunday, October 19th, Israel attacked areas across the Gaza Strip with more than 20 airstrikes, after the Israeli army claimed that Palestinian resistance forces had fired on an Israeli tank in the southern city of Rafah. But the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of the Hamas political party, said it was unaware of any events or clashes taking place in the Rafah area and noted that Israel had already been violating the terms of the ceasefire. According to Dropsite News' Ryan Grimm, the explosion was caused by an Israeli vehicle running over ordnance as the army was demolishing what was left of houses in Rafah. Grimm said, quote, soon after the explosion in Rafah, I'm told by a source familiar, the White House and Pentagon knew that the incident was caused by an Israeli settler bulldozer running over unexploded ordnance, contradicting Netanyahu's claim that Hamas had popped up from tunnels. Nevertheless, Israel took the opportunity to conduct massive airstrikes as Prime Minister and war crimes fugitive Benjamin Netanyahu announced that all crossings into Gaza for humanitarian aid were once again being closed as collective punishment. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud said on Sunday that, quote, fear and panic dominated the scene among people in Gaza during the series of airstrikes. He said, quote, we've been approached by people, including women and children, who are asking us if the war is back on. Some said now that Israel has got the captives back, they're back at killing us. That's the kind of sentiment we're hearing. People are very concerned in Gaza City after they returned following the ceasefire. They are cornered in this area. The sound of drones can be heard hovering above. The level of fear is on the rise. Let's not forget Palestinians have endured 2 years of war. They were not even given the chance to breathe with constant attacks. Israel targeted Palestinians in drone strikes while they were retrieving bodies in earlier attacks. Reporter Mohammed Abu Salama captured video of people at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City after Palestinians were targeted multiple times by an Israeli reconnaissance drone near Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza. The Gaza government media office stated on October 19th that Israel had committed 80 violations of the ceasefire since it came into effect, and that at least 97 Palestinians were killed and 230 injured in those 9 days since. Israel's violations, the media office explained, include shooting, bombing, the use of fire belts, and the arrest of Palestinians, reflecting, quote, its clear desire for escalation on the ground. The media office noted that these attacks had been carried out by occupation forces, quote, using military vehicles and tanks positioned on the outskirts of residential neighborhoods, electronic cranes equipped with sensors and remote targeting devices, and combat aircraft and quadcopter drones that continue to fly over residential areas on a daily basis, carrying out shooting operations and direct targeting of civilians. The Israeli military ended the October 19th bombing campaign after the U.S. White House appeared to have stepped in, Ryan Grimm added, conveying to Israel that they knew what happened with the Rafah explosion. Netanyahu said he would reopen 2 humanitarian aid crossings. However, Israeli forces in the so-called yellow boundary line within Gaza have continued to shoot and kill Palestinians. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, said that 4 Palestinians were killed on Monday in 2 separate attacks, both times by Israeli gunfire, as they were returning to their neighborhoods to check on their homes. Israeli forces claimed they opened fire on Palestinians who allegedly crossed the yellow line and approached troops in Shujaya. Al Jazeera reported that Hamas denied knowledge of any such attack, with one Palestinian official accusing Israel of fabricating pretext to resume the genocidal war on Gaza. On Wednesday, October 22nd, another Palestinian was killed by the Israeli army in the Tufah neighborhood of Gaza City. The Sulala Society, an animal rescue and rehabilitation organization in Gaza, announced that one of their veterinarians, Dr. Muadh Abu Rakba, was killed last weekend while trying to go back to his home and gather some belongings. His home was reportedly near the so-called yellow line boundary in Jabalia in northern Gaza. More Palestinian bodies were returned to Gaza by the Israeli military, showing indications of torture and field executions. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that its field team observed Israel's handover of 120 bodies from the Gaza Strip through the International Committee of the Red Cross last week, including many unidentified remains. Dozens more bodies have been returned to Gaza in recent days, raising the number to 195. Quote, medical examinations, forensic reports, and observations by the field team revealed conclusive evidence that many victims were killed after being detained, Euromed stated. Their bodies bore clear marks of hanging, rope imprints around their necks, injuries from close-range gunfire, bound hands and feet with plastic restraints and blindfolds. Some bodies were crushed under tank tracks, while others showed severe signs of physical torture, fractures, burns, and deep wounds. Dr. Munir Al-Bersh, the Director General of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, said that, quote, the bodies we received were bound like animals, blindfolded, and bore horrific signs of torture and burns that reveal the extent of the crimes committed in secret. They did not die naturally. They were executed after being restrained. These people were not buried underground. They were kept in the occupation's refrigerators for long months. Mahmoud Bassal of Gaza's civil defense filmed the mass funeral of 54 unidentified bodies in Deir al-Balah on Wednesday. Meanwhile, civil defense teams have been recovering hundreds of bodies from beneath the rubble in Gaza, working around the clock in brutal conditions while lacking the necessary heavy machinery and equipment to complete their missions. Mahmoud Bassal said that an estimated 10,000 Palestinians remain buried underneath the rubble, and he condemned the international community's double standards as members of the International Committee of the Red Cross began urgently recovering the bodies of Israeli captives while ignoring the enormous need for recovery of Palestinian bodies. Basal said, quote, "We receive dozens of appeals daily from families pleading for the recovery of their relatives' bodies." He added that he had provided all international organizations with detailed lists of our emergency needs and technical requirements for recovery operations. Quote, "Here in Gaza, humanity is divided by identity. Pain is measured by political standards, and the dead are left waiting for a justice that never comes," Basal said. In violation of not just the October 10th ceasefire, but of course all applicable international laws, Israel's continued restrictions on the entry of heavy machinery, food, essential supplies, medicine, and humanitarian aid are exacerbating the health catastrophe in Gaza. The Gaza government media office stated on Tuesday that fewer than 1,000 trucks, or roughly 15% of all expected aid trucks, have been delivered to Gaza, including only 14 cooking gas and 28 diesel trucks, since the ceasefire took effect. The media office emphasized that, quote, "These limited quantities do not cover the minimum humanitarian and living needs. The Gaza Strip is in dire need of an urgent and regular flow of no less than 600 aid trucks daily, including food, medical, and relief supplies, as well as fuel and cooking gas, to ensure the minimum requirements for a decent life." Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud said on Tuesday that he hadn't seen any trucks coming in through the Zakim crossing in the north of Gaza. He noted that there is no infrastructure, quote, "No warehouses, no roads for these trucks to drive on. Much of the city has been reduced to rubble, and the streets are difficult to navigate. For over 2 years now, we've been talking about aid, and nothing has changed. There's been a trickle that's been allowed in by Israel only to try to evade global criticism. But when you look, the amount is nowhere near sufficient to address the humanitarian crisis across the Gaza Strip." Abir Atefa of the World Food Programme explained on October 21st that international agencies are doing all they can to scale up the amount of food and supplies into Gaza, but are being hindered by Israel's ongoing closures of most of the crossings, as well as the unprecedented logistical obstacles with Gaza's infrastructure in collapse and ruin.
We've had over 6,700 tons of food. That's enough for close to 500,000 people for 2 weeks. Daily deliveries continue, and they are now averaging around 750 tons. That's much better than what we had before the ceasefire, but it's still well below our target, which is around 2,000 tons every day. Severe amount of destruction makes it, you know, almost impossible to get to this goal of 2,000 tons unless you are able to utilize all crossing points. People are showing up in large numbers, grateful for the efficiency of the delivery of food assistance, as well as the, you know, dignified way of people standing in line, quickly getting their food rations, and especially impacting the most vulnerable, the women, female-headed households, the elderly. People are hopeful. There is cautious optimism, but they are the food that they are receiving, they eat part of it, and they ration and keep some of the supplies for emergency because they are not very confident how long the ceasefire will last and what will happen next.
Abir Atefa of the World Food Programme. Looking at some of the political developments related to the genocide in Gaza, this week the Hind Rajab Foundation submitted a 120-page filing to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The filing names 24 Israeli soldiers and commanders responsible for the killing of Hind Rajab, 6 members of her family, and 2 Palestinian Red Crescent paramedics, Yusuf Al-Zeno and Ahmed Al-Madhoun, who were deliberately targeted while attempting to rescue her on January 29, 2024, in Gaza City. The submission provides detailed evidence identifying the, quote, "Vampire Empire Company of the 52nd Armored Battalion, operating under Israel's 401st Armored Brigade. The complaint names Colonel Benny Aharon, commander of the 401st Armored Brigade, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Ella, commander of the 52nd Armored Battalion, and Major Sean Glass, commander of the Vampire Empire Company, along with 22 identified tank crew members of the same company who directly participated in or facilitated the attack. On the same day the ICC submission was filed, Al Jazeera Arabic aired a new documentary called Tip of the Iceberg, in which the Hind Rajab Foundation publicly revealed the identities of the commanders and of tank crew member Itai Kukerkopf. The remaining 22 names have now been submitted confidentially to the ICC and will be made public progressively as national-level complaints are filed in different jurisdictions, the foundation states. Diab Abujaja, the foundation's director, said, quote, "This is not only a legal act. It's a revolt against the global order of impunity. They believed Hind's murder would be without accountability. We are proving them wrong, step by step." 24 names are now before the ICC, and more will follow in national courts. Justice is not a favor we ask. It is the inevitable reckoning of truth. And on Wednesday, the International Court of Justice issued its advisory opinion on the obligations of Israel in relation to the presence and activities of the United Nations, other international organizations, and third states in and relation to the occupied Palestinian territory. A brief document that concludes and reaffirms that Israel is an occupying power and is acting in violation of international law. Former UN official and frequent guest on the Electronic Intifada's live stream, Craig Mokhiber, stated on social media that, quote, "The ICJ has just rejected all objections and spurious defenses and found that the Israeli regime is in violation of international law in its obstruction of aid, its attacks on UNRWA and other agencies, its mass murder of hundreds of UN staff, its violations of the rights of aid workers, civilians, and prisoners, its destruction of UN and other aid facilities, the use of starvation as a method of war, and that it must cease all such actions in Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem." As usual, Israel regime agent Judge Sebu Tinde, who still has not recused or been removed, was alone in dissenting on several key findings of the court. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 9-year-old Palestinian boy while he was playing football in the Al-Rahiya village near Al-Khalil on October 16th. Defense for Children International reports that Mohammed Bahajat Mohammed Halak was playing along with several other young boys in the center of the village. Two Israeli military jeeps entered the village, after which four Israeli soldiers exited the vehicles, spread out along the street, and began firing tear gas canisters and live bullets randomly and directly at the children. As Mohammed and the other children fled westward, one soldier took a kneeling position and fired a single live bullet that struck Mohammed. He was shot in the right side of his pelvis, after which the bullet exited from his left side. Mohammed was able to take a few steps before falling to the ground when an additional tear gas canister was fired in his vicinity. A 17-year-old child came to carry Mohammed away when the soldiers fired two additional live bullets at them both. The older boy managed to pull Mohammed away and carried him to his uncle's house nearby. Mohammed was then taken in a private vehicle to a local hospital, where he was later pronounced dead. Defense for Children International Palestine says that Israeli forces have killed 41 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2025. On October 19th, in Al Ain refugee camp in Nablus in the north, a 42-year-old man, Majid Dawood, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers who then dragged his body across the city and then beat his wife before handing over his body. Journalist Abu Diem captured the Israeli soldiers assaulting Dawood's wife and trying to rip her husband's body away from her.
Oh!
And in the village of Tormosaya, Israeli settlers attacked Palestinians who were harvesting their olive trees, with one settler brutally beating a middle-aged woman, Afaf Abu Alia, with a large stick. U.S. journalist Jasper Nathaniel caught the moment the settler beat Abu Alia and the moments afterwards when locals and activists came to take her to get medical attention. Abu Alia spoke from the hospital on October 20th. She said that she had seen two settlers beating her. Quote, "I thought, that's it, I'm going to die. There was no one left, everyone had gone." Abu Alia says that she and her family members had gone out to pick their olives. A car passed by and a woman shouted at them to run because the settlers were coming. They ran and went to get their car and discovered that their car had been smashed and the tires had been deflated. She says that the army and security forces came and stopped them, but she and her family refused to leave. Then she says that one of the settlers hit her sister with a rock while they rode in a truck. She got up to see what was happening, and that's when the settlers started beating her. That video clip is from Middle East Eye with footage from Jasper Nathaniel. Nathaniel was also chased by a lynch mob of settlers while trying to document the attacks. He said that the Israeli army led him and Palestinian farmers directly into an ambush by settlers, then left the scene. On Wednesday, the Israeli government advanced a bill to annex and impose Israeli sovereignty on the entire occupied West Bank and another bill to impose Israeli sovereignty over the illegal settlement colony of Male Adumim. The Hamas political party said in a statement that the bills reflected, quote, "the ugly face of the colonial occupation. We affirm that the occupation's frantic attempts to annex West Bank lands are invalid and illegitimate," Hamas said. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight "Nothing to Return to" by Nadra Mushtaha, writing from Gaza. Quote, "Everything passes in ways that make no sense at all. My family and I ended up displaced to the south, despite our stubborn refusal to ever leave the north. And now we may suddenly be able to return. Maybe, just maybe, it will last this time," Nadra explains. She writes about preparing to head to the south as Israel's bombings escalated nearby. "I wished I could embrace our home and carry it with us. Mara, my 5-year-old sister sitting beside me, asked innocently, 'Can't we just fold up the house and take it with us to the south?' I replied softly, 'Why not fold up the whole city instead? Wouldn't that be better?' Later, I went down to the street to watch how they packed our bedding onto the transport truck. Then I walked to the patch of land in front of the house. My family was sitting there, peeling and eating pomelos picked from the tree outside the house, their faces heavy with grief. A memory forced itself into my mind. It was before the genocide, when my life was calm. I would sit on my bed, light a candle, and read my books and novels. I loved reading Ghassan Kanafani most of all. I often marveled at how his words seemed to mirror our lives, how his stories felt like our stories. I remembered one of his tales, The Land of Sad Oranges, and how the women wept when the last orange was taken from the orchard. The memory shook me, seeing my family holding those citrus fruits now. Was it possible that citrus would be the last thing we carried with us from our land, too? Our belongings left for the south before we did. There wasn't enough room for us on the small truck. We stayed behind in the house, hoping for another way out, but none came. Finally, after much thought, we decided to go on foot. Our only fear was for the 7 little ones, aged between 5 and 10, too frail for such a journey. We began to walk, my family, my relatives, 31 people in all. There were no streets left, no standing houses, only rubble. So we bade farewell to the ruins, ruins that had once been homes filled with life, and we moved on. From the very beginning of the road, exhaustion overtook us. I don't know why. It was a road we had walked countless times before. The heat was relentless. We weren't alone. Many families were carrying their belongings and mattresses while heavy shelling raged all around us. When we reached Al Rashid Street, which overlooks the sea, I couldn't believe my eyes. I had only seen part of the area in May. Before the war, Al Rashid Street was the very pulse of life. Bright, lively, full of cafes, restaurants, and wedding halls. Now all the towers lay in ruins. Everything seemed drowned in gray. I looked back and saw Al Majdal, Ashkelon, they call it now, glittering in the distance. The contrast was merciless. My city was buried under rubble and darkness, while over there, a city that was once ours sparkled like stars. We could see their light. Could they see our dark ruins? Our feet ached. Our backs felt broken from exhaustion. We stopped often to rest on the ground and catch our breath. We saw endless waves of displaced people. Like everyone else, I had set out in clean clothes that quickly became stained with dirt and dust. Hours and minutes passed. We reached Sheikh Ijlin, where we once had a beautiful plot with a large fig tree. The area now had no recognizable landmark. Still, when I walked by, I felt a warmth in my chest. We passed through Netzarim, once famed for its grapes and figs, now infamous for the many massacres Israel had perpetrated here. We reached Wadi Gaza, which marks the boundary between northern and southern Gaza, as the night swallowed the sky. At that moment, we became displaced. At the very threshold of the south, tents lined both sides of the road. Nothing looked familiar. It was not the city I knew. We arrived at the house we had rented from a family in Deir al-Balah, where we would now seek shelter at around midnight. I collapsed into sleep without even changing my clothes. The next morning, the air felt strange. I woke up confused, wondering why I wasn't at home. We remain in the south. Our house in Al-Shuja'iyya was bombed in the last days before the ceasefire. There is no home to go back to. Those are excerpts from Nothing to Return To by Nadra Mushtha, a teacher and writer in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Members of the Gaza Sunbirds, a paracycling team, brought long-awaited meals of chicken and rice to their friends this past week, as finally some food staples were brought into Gaza. One of the young men says, while holding a beautiful plate of roasted chicken, "I swear I've forgotten how it tastes. Now I'm going to remember what it tastes like." They knock on the door to their friend's house and celebrate together.
ذوق كمان ايش اخي
ليا يا ليا
بالراحه شباب
حد ايش سمعنا هو حدا
وين اكرم
اكرم
اجمع
تعال يا اكرم اكرم اخي
شباب
ايش الدنيا يا اخوي
لبيك اللهم لبيك
هيك بنقول ايش هيك الهدنة دخلت حيز التنفيذ يا شباب
لا بس كمل
And journalist Sameh Ahmed filmed his young daughter Lian entertaining herself and her dad by pretending that the window in the cloth tent they are using as a shelter is a television screen. Sameh says, quote, "My little girl Lian tries to create her own small world of joy inside the tent. With no electricity or television, she found in the tent's window her own screen. She stands before it, dancing and playing, asking me to sit and watch what she calls the TV. In every movement, there's a simple yet painful message. The children of Gaza need life, play, and education, just like all the children of the world."
Yo.
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. While apartheid Israel continues to prevent food, medicine, and many other essential goods and critical aid into the occupied and destroyed Gaza Strip for over 2 million Palestinians, the International Court of Justice issued an advisory ruling on October 22, 2025, on Israel's obligations in the occupied Palestinian territories. The ICJ basically has ruled that Israel must support United Nations relief efforts in Gaza, including those conducted by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, regarding Israel's legal responsibilities towards UN agencies and other international organizations operating in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Let's listen to Judge Iwasawa Yuji, President of the International Court of Justice, reading the verdict on October 22, 2025.
The court unanimously finds that it has jurisdiction to give the advisory opinion requested. Two, unanimously decides to comply with the request for an advisory opinion. Three, is of the opinion that the State of Israel as an occupying power is required to fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law. These obligations include the following. A, unanimously, to ensure that the population of the occupied Palestinian territory has the essential supplies of daily life, including food, water, clothing, bedding, shelter, fuel, medical supplies, and services. B, by 10 votes to 1, to agree to and facilitate by all means at its disposal, relief schemes on behalf of the population of the occupied Palestinian territory, so long as that population is inadequately supplied, as has been the case in the Gaza Strip, including relief provided by the United Nations and its entities, in particular, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, other international organizations and third states, and not to impede such relief. C, unanimously, to respect and protect all relief and medical personnel and facilities. D, unanimously, to respect the prohibition on forcible transfer and deportation in the occupied Palestinian territory. E, unanimously, to respect the right of protected persons from the occupied Palestinian territory who are detained by the State of Israel to be visited by the International Committee of the Red Cross. And F, unanimously, to respect the prohibition on the use of starvation of civilians as a method of warfare. Four, by 10 votes to 1, is of the opinion that, as an occupying power, the State of Israel has an obligation under international human rights law to respect, protect, and fulfill the human rights of the population of the occupied Palestinian territory, including through the presence and activities of the United Nations, other international organizations, and third states in and in relation to the occupied Palestinian territory. Five, by 10 votes to 1, is of the opinion that the State of Israel has an obligation to cooperate in good faith with the United Nations by providing every assistance in any action it takes in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations, including the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East in and in relation to the occupied Palestinian territory. Six, by 10 votes to 1, is of the opinion that the State of Israel has an obligation under Article 105 of the Charter of the United Nations to ensure full respect for the privileges and immunities accorded to the United Nations, including its agencies and bodies and its officials, in and in relation to the occupied Palestinian territory. 7, by 10-1, is of the opinion that the State of Israel has an obligation under Article 2 of the Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the United Nations to ensure full respect for the inviolability of the premises of the United Nations, including those of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, and for the immunity of the property and assets of the organization from any form of interference. 8, by 10-1, is of the opinion that the State of Israel has an obligation under Articles 5, 6, 7 of the Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the United Nations to ensure full respect for the privileges and immunities accorded to the officials and experts on mission of the United Nations in and in relation to the occupied Palestinian territory.
That was Judge Iwasawa Yuji, President of the International Court of Justice, reading the ICJ's verdict on October 22, 2025, on Israel's obligations in the occupied Palestinian territories. Soumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, published an article titled Stolen Lives: Every Freed Palestinian Carries the Weight of Their People's Struggle. She published that in the Middle East Eye after Israel released some of the Palestinian hostages from captivity. Let's listen to Soumaya's opinion summarizing that article she published.
They staggered out of the shadows like ghosts returning to the world of the living. On one side of the screen, Western camera zoomed in on the smiling faces of 20 freed Israeli men. Their names were broadcast, their families profiled, their reunions streamed live. On the other side, out of frame, almost invisible, nearly 2,000 Palestinians were bused to Gaza. No lights, no anchors, no headlines. The contrast was stark. For every Israeli released, 100 Palestinians. For every name the world heard, 100 names erased. Shadi Abu Sido, a photojournalist seized from Ashifa Hospital, was one of them. 20 months vanished in an Israeli cell. When his wife walked in, he rushed towards her like a man unhinged, clutching her as if she might disappear again. Then came the children, small, shaking, reaching out for a father they feared was gone. He fell to his knees. Through tears he cried, "They kept telling me you were all dead. They told me Gaza is gone." Ali Assais walked out after 20 years in prison. His daughter, a child when he was taken, now a young woman, ran to him weeping. He cupped her face between his palms and whispered softly, "You are my rose." There were no words for 2 decades stolen. For others, there was no one left to hold. Haytham Salem stepped out clutching a bracelet he had made for his daughter's birthday, 3 days away, only to discover that his wife and all 3 of his little children had been killed. He collapsed to the ground weeping, "My children have died. My children have died." That same morning, the father of journalists, Saleh Jafarawi, buried his son. Hours later, his eldest, Naji, was released from jail. "Where is Saleh?" he asked. His father whispered, "He was martyred yesterday." Naji collapsed, his grieving elderly father desperately trying to console him. Some were released not to their homes but to exile. Murad Abu Rub from Ramallah was deported to Egypt instead of returning home. His sister had bought him a suit for the day of his release, guessing his size because she hadn't held him for 20 years. But the news came suddenly. He was gone without a goodbye. The Israeli authorities prepared trauma teams for their own returnees and found them smiling, walking on camera. The Palestinians emerged with starved faces, visible bones, sunken eyes. This isn't incidental, it is policy. Human rights groups and UN bodies have documented the system: savage beatings, electric shocks, stress positions, sexual violence, dog attacks, cigarette burns, starvation, denial of medicine, prayer, even sleep. The cruelty is written into their bodies. Some return so changed even their mothers don't recognize them. One widely shared video shows a mother staring blankly at her son after 2 years of imprisonment until someone whispers his name. She breaks down, clutching him through tears, crying, "This is Hamza, oh Hamza Habibi." Consider Dr. Adnan Al-Burj, an orthopedic surgeon taken from Al-Awda Hospital to Sidi Tayman, a black site of beatings and electric shocks. There, guards raped him and left him to bleed to death in the courtyard. When footage surfaced, the protest outside wasn't against the torture, but to defend the guards' right to rape Palestinians. While Netanyahu invokes the return of Israeli bodies to justify breaking the ceasefire, Israel holds the bodies of hundreds of Palestinians killed in captivity. An autopsy of one returned Israeli hostage revealed he was killed by Israeli bombardment, the same bombs that flattened Gaza and buried thousands beneath the rubble. Bodies returned by Israel after the ceasefire told another story, bodies bearing the unmistakable marks of torture and gunshots. The outcry for the dead Israeli captives was global, relentless, but for the scores of Palestinians kidnapped, tortured, executed, there was silence. No names, no numbers, no faces, just mothers scanning the lines of the newly released, whispering through their tears, "Have you seen my son?" Under the current deal, Israel will return 15 Palestinian bodies for every deceased Israeli captive. Estimates of the number of Palestinian bodies held by Israel range between 600 and 700, possibly more. Israel's policy of withholding bodies is one of its most chilling cruelties. More than 9,100 Palestinians remain behind bars, including 52 women and nearly 400 children. Over 3,500 are held under administrative detention without charge or trial. Hundreds more, many from Gaza, are held under Israel's unlawful combatant law, a legal black hole that allows indefinite detention with no due process. The pain of these prisons is not confined to their walls. It bleeds into homes. The knock at night, the dawn raid, the sound of boots, children crying, loved ones dragged away. In Palestine, prison isn't just a place. It's a shadow that stalks life from cradle to grave. How occupation disciplines the body, crushes the spirit, colonizes time. We call some hostages. We call others prisoners. One word evokes innocence and urgency. The other, presumption and guilt. But everyone knows the truth. A whole people held hostage by siege, by military rule, by a carceral machine built to crush. The world grieves loudly for 19 Israeli hostages beneath the rubble and turns away from more than 10,000 Palestinians buried there. 1 to 500, a ratio that distills a century of dehumanization into cold arithmetic. For Palestinians, the prisoner has always been at the heart of the struggle. Long before this occupation, under the British mandate, prison cells were the crucible of defiance. The song commemorates three young men, Muhammad Jamjoum, Fuad Hajazi, and Ata Azir, executed by the British in January 1930 after the Al-Buraq revolt a year earlier. Their names still live on Palestinian lips, sung across generations, because Palestinians do not forget their prisoners. They never have. And this story isn't theirs alone. From South Africa to Ireland, from Algeria to Kenya, empire built prisons to break those it colonized. But from those cells came songs, manifestos, revolutions. Nelson Mandela walked out and defeated apartheid. In Lonkesh, Irish Republican prisoners turned their bodies into the last word of protest, their hunger echoing beyond the bars. The men and women who walked out this week are not just individuals. They're the living thread of a struggle older than this occupation, shared by every people who has felt a boot on the neck and chosen to rise. Because the story of the prisoner is never just about the prisoner. It's about a people who refuses to submit. It's about the stubborn, beautiful, unbreakable human will to be free. As Irish hunger striker Bobby Sands put it, our revenge will be the laughter of our children.
That was Soumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. The Gaza Tribunal, an independent international initiative investigating war crimes and acts of genocide committed by apartheid Israel in the Gaza Strip, held its final session in Istanbul, Turkey, on October 23, 2025, an event that will last through October 26. I plan to talk more about it and air some of the remarks delivered at that tribunal during future episodes of Arab Voices, but I'm going to share with you during this episode the speech of Avi Schleim, Jewish history professor and one of the world's leading Middle East historians, speaking about Zionist settler colonialism. He delivered these remarks on October 23rd at the Gaza Tribunal final session.
The Zionist movement was a settler colonial movement, and Israel is a settler colonial state. The logic of settler colonialism is the elimination of the natives as a prelude to taking over the land and its resources. The undeclared but real objective of the Zionist movement from the beginning has been to build a Jewish state on as large part of historic Palestine as possible, with as few Arabs inside its borders as possible. Today, Israel effectively controls 100% of historic Palestine. There is an Arabic saying that something that starts crooked remains crooked. The Zionist movement could not have achieved this amazing degree of success without the support of Western imperialism. Noam Chomsky noted that settler colonialism is the most extreme and vicious form of imperialism. For the last century, the Palestinians have been at the receiving ends of Zionist settler colonialism on the one hand and Western imperialism on the other, with Britain playing the leading part until 1948, and America playing the leading part since 1967. In 1917, Britain issued the Balfour Declaration, pledging support for a Jewish state in Palestine. At that time, the Jews were 10% of the population, and they owned only 2% of the land. So the Balfour Declaration was a classic colonial document which completely disregarded the rights and aspirations of the local population. Last month, Britain recognized Palestine. This was welcome, but it was pathetically little, and it was 107 years too late. The story of the British Mandate in Palestine is essentially the story of how Britain stole Palestine from the Palestinians and gave it to the Zionists. The cornerstone of mandatory policy was to withhold elections, to avoid democracy, for so long as the Arabs constituted a majority. The Jews only became a majority as a result of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine during the 1948 war. 750,000 Palestinians became refugees, and the name Palestine was wiped off the map. This is the Nakba, the catastrophe. The Nakba, however, is not a one-off event, but an ongoing process of displacement and dispossession of the native population by the colonial power. This process reached its cruel and indeed its sadistic climax with the genocide in Gaza and with the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank in the aftermath of the Hamas attack of the 7th of October. In the Arab world, Israel is widely seen as an illegitimate entity, as an outpost of Western imperialism, as a foreign body planted in the heartland of the Arab world with the intention of dividing and weakening them. This is an oversimplification of history. Nevertheless, it is true that Western support was crucial to the establishment of Israel in 1948 and to the persistence of the colonial empire beyond Israel's original lines since 1967. America is Israel's closest friend and indispensable ally. America gives Israel military aid and diplomatic protection. The problem with American support for Israel is that it is unconditional. It is unconditional. It is not conditional on respecting Palestinian human rights or international law. This is how Israel gets away literally with murder. This is why Israel can continue to act with complete impunity. This is why the international community is unable to call Israel to account for its multiple crimes and egregious violations of international humanitarian law. Benjamin Netanyahu's current government embodies all the most negative aspects of Zionist settler colonialism. It is the most far-right, reactionary, crudely populist, messianic, overtly racist, and territorially expansionist government in Israel's history. Settler violence has dramatically escalated on the West Bank since the 7th of October, with the encouragement of the government and the protection of the army. The extremists in the government openly declare that their ultimate aim is the formal annexation of the West Bank and Jewish resettlement in Gaza. The government exploited the trauma of the 7th of October to intensify the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. A leaked report of the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence outlined concrete plans for depopulating Gaza. Egyptian opposition prevented Israel from implementing this plan, but it did not prevent Israel from achieving its principal aim, namely to make Gaza uninhabitable. Under Netanyahu's leadership, Israel has also committed the crime of all crimes, genocide. Genocide is not just a legal concept, but a fundamentally moral issue. It is the denial of the right to exist of a whole group of people. Israel's national identity is inextricably linked with the Holocaust. But Israel is no longer the victim, if it has ever been. Whereas in the Second World War, the Jews were the defenseless victims of Nazi Germany. Today, it's the Palestinians who are the defenseless victims of the Jewish state. In a sense, the war in Gaza is a direct result of the Balfour Declaration. The combination of Zionist settler colonialism and Western imperialism is the root cause of the Palestinian tragedy. In Gaza, over the last 2 years, the injustice, the immorality, the inhumanity, and indeed the sadism of Zionist settler colonialism towards the native population have reached a new climax. Given the origins of Israel as a settler colonial state, as Francesca Albanese has pointed in one of her brilliant reports, Given the origins of Israel as a settler colonial state, this was a tragedy foretold. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Avi. Are there any questions from the jury? Sami.
Thank you very much, Avi, for your presentation. A very quick question. If we look at the history of settler colonial states, particularly France with Algeria, what future do you see of this conflict? Do you see it along these lines or along the lines of South Africa, where they would be settled and try to integrate? What kind of future do you see in light of what you know about the Zionist ideology?
I believe that apartheid is not sustainable into the 21st century. White apartheid in South Africa ended as a result of international pressure, and I believe that eventually Israel will go down the same way. The impulse to change will not come from within. The pressure from outside would push Israel to end the apartheid regime. And I don't believe that partition is a solution to this problem. I don't think that partition was ever a solution from the beginning. It's one unit. And no one suggested in South Africa that you should divide the country into two states, one black and one white. But people are suggesting now that you have two states, one Jewish, one Arab. It has never worked and it will never work, and therefore I advocate one state from the river to the sea with equal rights for all who live in that space, equal freedom and equal rights for all the people who live in that space, regardless of religion and ethnicity.
That was Avi Schleim, Jewish history professor and one of the world's leading Middle East historians, speaking about Zionist settler colonialism at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey on October 23, 2025. I plan to air more remarks delivered at the Gaza Tribunal final session during future episodes of Arab Voices. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.